Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
In 1941, the architects of Japan's sneak attack on Pearl Harbor planned a bold follow-up, a classified program to build a squadron of underwater aircraft carriers designed to launch another surprise and incredibly destructive air raid, this time against New York City and Washington, D.C. The mission is written about in the new book Operation Storm, Japan's Top Secret Submarines and Its Plan to Change the Course of World War II. The book is written by aviation historian John Gehagan, and it's a pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
What brought you to this particular story about these submarines and ultimately Operation Storm?
Operation Storm's a pretty unusual story. It's little known, I think, in part because it's a story about an amazing Japanese underwater mission during World War II. As you probably know, Admiral Yamamoto conceived a squadron of underwater aircraft carriers that were essentially the largest submarines ever built, certainly during World War II, and there wasn't another submarine that exceeded them in size until 1961. And these submarines were essentially underwater aircraft carriers. They each carried three special attack planes in a watertight deck hangar and were launched off the sub's foredeck. And they were designed to surface off the east coast of the United States and launch an aerial attack against New York City and Washington, D.C. as a follow-up to Yamamoto's attack on Pearl Harbor.
Give us a sense of how this plan was developed and hatched, and the timeline, as you mentioned, post-Pearl Harbor. But how did it develop? Was it a quick development?
Yes. Okay. So it was interesting. Admiral Yamamoto really needed a kind of follow-up punch to Pearl Harbor. He did not have a second act. And so he conceived the idea for this E-400 class of submarines, these underwater aircraft carriers, directly after the attack on Pearl Harbor. He actually brought his officers, his naval officers, on board his flagship. I think it was late December 1941, early January 1942. To have a meeting about, okay, we've had a success at Pearl Harbor, but we need to come up with some kind of audacious plan that will force the United States to the negotiating table and sue for an early peace. And Yamamoto was a naval tactician and quite comfortable with using airplanes and aircraft, but he was not a submariner. So it was a really quite a creative bit of thinking on his plan to say, okay, well, we'll never be able to slip another carrier fleet past the United States, but let's come up with a squadron of underwater aircraft carriers and see if we could use that for an aerial attack on their two most important cities. Well, so that was very early in the war. The problem was it took several years to design these submarines, which had never been created before. There really was no such thing like this that existed in any navy anywhere. So 1942, 1943 were largely devoted to the design and construction of these submarines. And they didn't start to be launched until 1944, late 44, in fact, November and December. And that was quite late in the war. And, of course, the situation had dramatically changed for the Japanese. They were no longer playing an offensive game. They were very much on the defense. And so the missions on these submarines evolved accordingly. You know, the first plan was to strike New York City and Washington, D.C. Later on in the war, after Midway, when the battle turned against the Japanese, it was clear that they would not be able to get close to the eastern United States coastline. So they repurposed them and said, okay, let's use them to attack the Panama Canal. And that was the mission that they trained for the majority of the war, with the goal of closing down the Gatun locks, destroying the Gatun locks on the Caribbean side of the Panama Canal, and stopping the flow of men and materials from the United States and the Allies through the canal to the Pacific Ocean. And so that was really the mission that took up most of the planning. And it wasn't until the subs were actually launched in 44 and early 45 that they realized, well, it was too late even to close off the Panama Canal. The U.S. was obviously well established in the Pacific by that point in the war. And in fact, the Japanese were very much concerned about the impending invasion, Operation Olympic, which was planned for November of 1945. So the mission that the subs actually were deployed on was to attack the U.S. carrier forces that were amassing at Ulithi Atoll in the Pacific in preparation for the invasion of Japan.
I think one of the most intriguing aspects of the story is the fact that U.S. intelligence was able to break the Japanese naval code, but even with that, the mission remained unknown to the U.S.
Yes, when I interviewed the captain of the E-401, which was the flagship submarine in the squadron of underwater aircraft carriers, he told me that he wanted to follow strict radio silence on the mission, in part because it was his belief that U.S. naval intelligence had cracked the Imperial Japanese Navy codes. And so once they set out from Japan in July 1945, he basically went into a radio silence mode. And it was because of that that he was able to get as far in his mission as he did, because basically we were listening and reading their mail in a lot of detail. There was one of the subs, though, that were part of the squadron. It was the E-13. And that was the only sub that we were able to track down and sink before it got on station. And the reason that we think that we were able to sink it, or I think we were able to sink it, is they did not maintain radio silence. And there are cables in the National Archives that show that we were tracking the movement of this one particular sub. And as a result, we were able to find it and sink it before it was able to complete its mission.
One of the chilling aspects, of course, is just how close the Japanese came to pulling it off. And at what point in your research did you realize that?
Well, yes, it is remarkable to me how close they got to actually completing their mission. And I mean, obviously, I knew when I began the research, which took me almost 5 years. I knew they hadn't completed the mission, or I would have heard about it. Mm. But I really didn't realize that at the end, once the surrender announcement was made by the Emperor of Japan in August 15th, 1945, I didn't realize that the flagship sub, the E-401, decided to ignore the Emperor's surrender orders and continue on with the mission. Until I met with the captain of the E-401, who's still alive today, and he told me about what transpired on the sub, that they actually refused to acknowledge the surrender orders, and he took the submarine rogue and went on to complete the mission. And it was, I think, they were 7 hours away from launching their aircraft against our carrier forces in Ulithi when he finally received a direct order from the Sixth Fleet, which was the Imperial Japanese Navy sub-command, ordering him to stand down. And so at that point, he had no choice. He did have to stand down because it was a direct order from his command. But, I mean, they were 7 hours away from launching an attack on our carrier forces in what was essentially a ceasefire period. It's amazing because the ramifications of what could have happened if they had launched that, could have had a triggering of combat hostilities when the war was essentially supposed to be over.
It is such a riveting story, and it does make you wonder why it has become such a little-known aspect of the conflict in the Pacific Theater.
Well, yes, and I wrestled with that question myself, and I think there are a couple of answers to that. I mean, one is, it is essentially a Japanese story. It's a Japanese story of courage and determination against seemingly insurmountable odds. And so those types of stories of courage by your enemy, I don't think really emerge in history until you're well past the initial incident. And I think the other reason, of course, is that we managed to capture a couple of these subs at the end of World War II and transport them to Pearl Harbor so that we could basically inspect their technology and see if it made sense to adopt the Japanese sub-technology in our next future generation of submarines. And so that was, in large parts, a classified operation. And when the Russians found out in March of 1946 that we had these game-changing submarines in our possession, they actually requested the opportunity to inspect the subs themselves. What was the dawning of the Cold War, and we were not about to let the Russians get hold of these subs. So once we'd completed our inspection, and before the Russians were able to actually see the subs for themselves, we took them out and torpedoed them to keep them out of the hands of the Russians. So I think that also helped create a kind of conspiracy of silence about these you know, amazing underwater aircraft carriers. We didn't want the enemy to really know about them or get their hands on them. And we actually created something of an international incident when we sunk the subs. The Russians filed a protest. There was an articles in the New York Times about it. So, all in all, it was a chapter in history that we wanted to keep quiet.
What impact did that search and that investigation into the technology have, if any, on our future naval technology?
Well, you know, at the end of the war, the U.S. was quite organized about getting hold of enemy access technology that they thought could help us in the future. And, you know, we brought Wernher von Braun and his men over and they became the backbone of our ballistic missile system and our space program. Well, we did the same with German and Japanese submarine technology. We captured a number of German submarines, next-generation German submarines, and brought them over to Pearl Harbor for inspection, and did the same with the E-400 class of subs. I don't think that the sub-technology itself was so advanced that we were impressed enough to use it in our next-generation fleet boats, but the strategic concept of the E-400 subs, which was basically using a submarine as an offensive weapon to attack an enemy's cities, that was a game-changing tactical development. And we very much incorporated that strategy in the 1950s going forward in all of our ballistic missile submarines. And in fact, in the 1950s, we developed the Regulus nuclear missile, which was a sub-launched missile that was contained in a watertight deck hangar on the sub's foredeck, very similar to the design of the E-400 subs. So you can see that the strategic value of the E-400 subs was in helping us develop our future ballistic missile submarines and our nuclear deterrent strategy that we employ today.
Well, it's such an interesting facet of naval history, and it's a fascinating book. It's Operation Storm, Japan's Top Secret Submarines and Its Plan to Change the Course of World War II. The book is published by Crown. John Gehagan, I thank you very much for being with us this morning. A great pleasure.
Thoroughly enjoyed being with you. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Operation Storm, Japan's Top Secret Submarines and Its Plan to Change the Course of World War II. The book is published by Crown. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.